Okay, we just listened to BBC News, and they had one item that some gentleman was referring to the fact that the world has billions of dollars to bail out the bankers and not enough money to feed the poor. What's the point? Does feeding the poor increase my stock account? Does it benefit my rich friends? I don't understand the point he was making. In case anybody wants some information in similar subjects, when I was down in SAC on a TV show, they told me about an interesting newspaper. It's called Rock Creek Free Press. It might be available at Briar Patch Co-op and other co-ops. It's a free newspaper. And let me just read you the front page to give you an idea. There's an article in Israel Guilty of War Crimes in Gaza. Another article, Anthrax Attack Spawned in Military Bioweapons Lab. Another article, Goldman Sachs Bonuses Double. Congress moves to bar release of abuse photos. Unanswered questions haunt family of Oklahoma City bombing first responder. Obama tops Bush in troop buildup. Nuclear Israel, number one threat in Mideast. The 9/11 Commission rejects its own report as based on government lies. And Honduran people resist coup. So, sounds like the sort of thing that rabble-rousing listeners might be interested in. Evidently, it comes out of Bethesda, Maryland, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C. It's called the Rock Creek Free Press. You might ask around for it. Well, okay, so today is November 18th, I do believe. Today's show. Well, if you're not going to follow your helpful government's advice and run down for a flu shot, what will you do? Here's one suggestion from a listener. Don't laugh till you tried it. This article brought back memories of when my oldest son used to get colds all the time when he was little. This lady told me to cut an onion and rub it on his chest. The onion turned very black and my son soon felt better. Also, there was a young woman where I grew up who used to cut garlic and onion, put it in a sock, and pin it to her little girl's undershirt. At the time, I thought it was a terrible thing to do to a child, having her walk around smelling like onions and garlic. But I guess she just wanted to keep her little girl healthy. In 1919, when the flu killed 40 million people, there was this doctor that visited the many farmers to see if he could help them combat the flu. Many of the farmers and their family had contracted it, and many died. The doctor came upon this one old farmer, and to his surprise, everyone in the family was healthy. When the doctor asked what the farmer was doing that was different, the wife replied that she'd placed an unpeeled onion in a dish in the room of the home. In the rooms of the home. It was probably only two rooms back then. The doctor couldn't believe it and asked if he could have one of the onions and place it under a microscope. She gave him one, and when he did this, he did find the flu virus in the onion. It obviously absorbed the bacteria, therefore keeping the family healthy. Now, I heard this story from my hairdresser in Arizona. She said that several years ago, many of her employees were coming down with the flu, and so were many of her customers. The next year, she placed several bowls with onions around in her shop. To her surprise, none of her staff got sick. It must work. And no, she's not in the onion business. The moral of the story is, buy some onions and place them in bowls around your home. If you work at a desk, place one or two in your office or under your desk or even up on top somewhere. Try it. See what happens. We did it last year, and we never got the flu. If this helps you and your loved ones from getting sick, all the better. If you do get the flu, it just might be a mild case. Whatever. What do you have to lose? Just a few bucks on onions. Now, there's a P.S. to this, for I sent the story to a friend in Oregon who regularly contributes material to me on health issues. She replied with this most interesting experience about onions. Thanks for the reminder. I don't know about the farmer story, but I do know that I contacted pneumonia, and needless to say, I was very ill. I came across an article that said to cut both ends off an onion, put one end on a fork, and then place the forked end to an empty jar, placing the jar next to the sick patient at night. It said the onion would be black in the morning from the germs. Sure enough, it happened just like that. The onion was a mess, and I began to feel better. So, there you've got it. Folk wisdom from Rabble Rousing. My commentary for today, November 18th. Is anyone else growing just a little bit tired of hearing about the Israeli government sticking it to the Palestinians? This morning's news featured yet another story of the Israeli government demolishing Arab-owned structures in order to build more houses for Jews. President Obama has repeatedly told the Israelis he wanted them to cease building new settlements in the occupied West Bank and disputed land in Jerusalem. Israel told Obama to pound sand. They would do whatever they wanted to. They've just issued building permits for several hundred new buildings in Arab Jerusalem. The bulldozers have just begun demolishing Arab homes to make way for more Jewish settlements. The excuse for the bulldozing was that the Arab structures were built without permits, and hence were illegal. That's an interesting line of logic, as most of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank were originally built without permits. When I lived in Israel many, many, many years ago, many homes were built without permits. It was a common practice. Do we detect a double standard here? Please note that Obama's government annually gives Israel's government billions of dollars in unspecified aid unconditionally. It's a sweetheart deal only equaled by our largesse towards our own banks. You know, the ones who are too large to fail. I suspect there's a similar logic applied here. Israel is considered too important to fail, so we allow them to do whatever they please to the Arabs living amongst them as second-class citizens. Apartheid is alive and well in the Promised Land. The fact remains that we could stop all confiscation of Arab properties and Jewish construction on those properties instantly. We could have stopped the recent massacre in Gaza if we'd wanted to. We could exert great influence over Israel if we wanted to. Just cut off the billions we annually give Israel. Stop mistreating the Palestinians amongst you, or we'll stop paying you to do so. For in effect, that's exactly what we're doing, as Israel does not need nor use our foreign aid for feeding its people, building schools, roads, electricity plants, or other infrastructure, or in any way improving the lives of its citizens. The money goes to the Israeli military, which not only defends the country from its obvious foreign enemies, but also suppresses and subjugates the Palestinians who have lived within its borders long before the State of Israel existed. We could stop all of this if we wanted to. We obviously don't want to. Question, who is we? Next question, when is enough enough? What will it take before those in power in Washington, D.C. tell the Israeli government either you start right now to treat the Palestinians with respect and treat them fairly, or we will cut off all aid to you and you're on your own. You make your bed, you lie in it. We're no longer bedmates. And the final question, of course, is, do the American people have enough say in their own government to require our elected representatives to demand that this policy be followed? Let's see now. What's the track record so far? We didn't want to go to war with Iraq. What happened? We want single-payer health care. What is happening? What can we do to take back our government so they stop using our tax dollars and our children to kill innocents abroad in the name of empire maintenance and corporate profits? Let me remind listeners that our guest of a few weeks back, Kevin Swanson, will be speaking on these issues this Friday in Grass Valley and Saturday in Sacramento. The address in Grass Valley is the Unitarian Universalist Church on South Church Street. And if someone has the Sacramento address, please phone it in to me. Next item. BBC News this morning devoted some of their limited broadcast time to a story of turmoil around a soccer match in the Middle East and another story on Formula One car racing. I'm sure relieved that there were no more important news to report. One further comment. I noticed that the media, mainstream media, gives us some information and omits others, other bits of information. We know that Bernard Madoff was a Jew. We know that this guy Hassan, the alleged Fort Hood shooter, was Muslim. We usually know when the perpetrator of a crime is black. Very often we know they're Latin. But, we also know their alcohol level. We know if alcohol was found in their system. If the evil weed Marajahuchi was in their system, we're certainly told about that. But we're never told what prescription medication the perpetrators were on. Specifically, we're never told if they were on antidepressants. And even more important, we're never told if they'd recently come off antidepressants. The medical literature is filled with cautions about antidepressants, and even more cautions about the effects of going off antidepressants. But we're never told if any of these perpetrators were on them, especially the violent perpetrators. We're not given the information that we need in order to make informed choices when our doctors recommend specific medications for us. How can we make informed choices about drugs that we put in our system if we're not given this sort of information? Let's talk about those Fort Hood shootings. The Fort Hood shootings are filling our media. One lone nut gunman who happens to be Muslim. End of the story? Well, not quite. Here's another take. This is from Jerry Mazza, writing in onlinejournal.com. He calls it Major Nidal Malik Hassan, jihadists or patsy. The story, as it unwinds, seems to be too scripted to be true. The Army psychiatrist, Major Nidal M. Hassan, went on a rampage at Fort Hood with two guns blazing, a .357 Magnum and a semi-automatic pistol with laser target finder, after shouting the Arabic phrase, Allah Akbar, God is great, as he opened fire. And he'll live, so far, to talk about it. Through an Army-appointed lawyer, says he'll never get a fair trial. Hassan coincidentally received his master's in chemistry at Virginia Tech, famous for the infamous Sung Hui Chu, the campus killer gunman credited in April 2007 with the deadliest shooting rampage in modern history. Sung Hui's sister curiously works for a State Department office that oversees billions of dollars in American aid for Iraq. See the link to Citizens for Legitimate Government on him and his missing records. It's more of the script, the association of Hassan with Sung Hui. Consider, too, that in 2007, Major Hassan, who received his medical degree in psychiatry from Walter Reed Hospital, spoke there, warning of threats within the ranks of Muslim soldiers in a 50-slide PowerPoint presentation titled The Quranic Worldview as it Relates to Muslims in the U.S. Military. He stood before his supervisors and about 25 other mental health staff members and lectured on Islam, suicide bombers, and threats the military could encounter from Muslims conflicted about fighting in the Muslim countries of Iraq and Afghanistan. This was reported by in the November 10th Washington Post, which includes Hassan's entire presentation. Hassan went so far as to say, quote, "It's getting harder and harder for Muslims in the service to morally justify being in a military that seems constantly engaged against fellow Muslims," close quote. How and why these words didn't get his military superiors to question him seems beyond understanding, unless that, too, was part of the script. Could it be that they felt he was speaking the truth? But there's a more than veiled threat in the presentation, which you'll see if you read it. In fact, Hassan entered Walter Reed in 2003 and spent 6 years as an intern, resident, and fellow. He was transferred to Fort Hood as a psychiatrist in July 2009 and was to leave soon for Afghanistan, and had asked on numerous occasions not to be deployed. He even offered the U.S. government its money back for his Walter Reed education, every dollar of it. He did not want to fight fellow Muslims. Yet no one raised an eye? This is the U.S. Army major speaking, not some slacker from the sticks trying to dodge combat. Of course, aside from his glaringly strong, if not correct, feelings against the Iraq and Afghan wars, his supervisors found him quite competent, counseling wounded soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Then there's a quote she'd known Hassan from his supervisor. You wouldn't think that someone who works in your facility and provides excellent care for his patients, which he did, could do something like this. She described him as a quiet man who wouldn't seek the limelight and said she was shocked when she heard he was the suspect in the shooting. This is all vaguely reminiscent of supposedly communist sympathizer Harvey Oswald and his feelings for Cuba, which purportedly drove him towards a similar lone gunman assassination of President Kennedy, which today is amply questioned by millions of Americans who believed it involved the CIA, the mob, the defense industry, and George H.W. Bush Sr., amongst a number of the usual suspects. Yet an ABC News headline from November 9th screams, "Officials, U.S. Army told of Hassan efforts to contact al-Qaeda. Army major in Fort Hood massacre used electronic means, a computer, to connect with terrorists. U.S. intelligence agencies were aware months ago that Army Major Nidal Malik Hassan was attempting to make contact with an individual associated with al-Qaeda," two American officials briefed on classified material in the case told ABC News. According to the officials, the Army was informed of Hassan's contact, but it's unclear what, if anything, the Army did in response. Why is it unclear? Or is it just being withheld? Or is there nothing of consequence to report? Or is it a sheer lie? This is coming from ABC News, which on every anniversary of JFK's assassination runs a last word piece on how it was committed by a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, the network being a long-standing CIA front. And here they've automatically established that the fabled al-Qaeda, created, funded, and branded by the CIA, was in contact with Major Hassan. So what did they do about it? That's right, nothing. Read the balance of the article for the indignant ire of the politician so reminiscent of all the leads to the CIA and other presences in the JFK assassination, whose inquiry was led by Alan Dulles, the CIA head Kennedy fired for the creation of the Bay of Pigs invasion. Of course, echoing ABC News is the New York Times, with U.S. knew of suspects tied to radical cleric. Aha! Even more ties on the path to jihad. Even more foreknowledge. Intelligence agencies intercepted communications last year and this year between the military psychiatrist accused of shooting to death 13 people at Fort Hood, Texas, and a radical cleric in Yemen known for his incendiary anti-American teachings. And what did they do about it? Quote, "But the federal authorities dropped an inquiry into the matter after deciding that the messages from the psychiatrist did not suggest any threat of violence, and concluding that no further action was warranted," government officials said Monday. Well then, why mention it in the first place? It goes on. Major Hassan's 10 to 20 messages to Anwar al-Awlaki, once a spiritual leader at a mosque in suburban Virginia where Major Hassan worshipped, indicate that the troubled, now he's nuts, military psychiatrist came to the attention of the authorities long before last Thursday's shooting rampage at Fort Hood, but the authorities left him in his post. Why? 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 Unless it's all sheer BS. Is this not reminiscent of 9/11 and the continued incompetence before, during, and after it, of various intelligence and government agencies, not to mention NORAD, the Pentagon, the executive branch? And nary a soul was fired after the terrible event. All they could do is blame 19 headshots of Muslims pulled out of a file by FBI Director Robert Mueller, who wouldn't claim with complete surety their authenticity. And then the next step was declaring the war on terror and preemptively, illegally, attacking Afghanistan, supposedly in search of the Muslim goat, Osama bin Laden, who supposedly engineered it. Several years after 9/11, he was taken off the FBI's most wanted list for the crime, for lack of evidence to prove he was responsible for it. And then there was Iraq, claiming the time when the Muslim goat Hassan Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was about to use them any second, which was subsequently proved totally false. So now Hassan is buried in al-Qaeda next to a radical cleric with strong anti-American teachings. Pay dirt. The news networks have created a grid-like spider web that holds its fly morsel Hassan to shame Islam. Does this not buttress the whole sagging conspiracy theory of the administration, particularly as more and more books, DVDs, architects, engineers, military men, pilots speak out against the flaws in the administration's 9/11 conspiracy theory? Does this not hit us over the head again with a "Muslim did it, remember 9/11? Why was the intelligence at Fort Hood, the FBI, and CIA asleep at the wheel? Perhaps part of the script? It also comes out in the same time story listed above. In 2000 and 2001, the Muslim cleric, Mr. Awalaki, served as an imam at two mosques in the United States, frequented by three future September 11th hijackers. Both Mr. Hazmi and another hijacker, Hani Hanjour, later attended the Dal al-Hiraj Mosque in Falls Church, Virginia. The September 11th Commission report expressed suspicion about the coincidence, but said its investigators were unable to find Mr. Awalaki to question him. Yeah, but... Major Hassan ascended the same Virginia mosque, but it's not known whether they met there. Attended the same Virginia mosque, but it's not known whether they met there. Hassan attended the same mosque, but it's not known if he and Hani, the idiot who couldn't fly a Cessna, met there. But nevertheless, we take from this, if your political IQ isn't below 40, the implication that Hassan was connected to the hijackers because he's a nut-killer terrorist too. Yet who left him to do his killing but the very people in charge of his career? Or maybe someone in the back room said, "Hands off, Hassan. We have other plans for him. He's in the bigger picture." And so, much like Oswald or David Chapman, who shot John Lennon, Chapman then calmly sat down on the sidewalk after he did it, waiting for the police to come and take him away, his handler, the doorman, Jose Perdomo, was gone for the day, saying bye-bye to Chapman, as this Manchurian patsy went off to life imprisonment. And not in a mental hospital, but in a straight-up prison, which he, quote, chose to do. And yet there's more. Hassan supposedly wasn't the lone gunman. No, he had three accomplices. They say one dead and two in custody. Sort of makes sense. I mean, to kill 13 people and wound 29 in a matter of minutes, supposedly thrusting 100 rounds of ammo into the clips of his two pistols, Hassan would have to be John Wayne plus Superman. It would ruin the whole movie. But who are the accomplices? Well, there's an account from CNN of the capture of one of them on a golf course 2.5 miles away as 30 to 40 sirening cars full of MPs came to get him. Here's the short piece. It's from CNN. A senior officer who was playing golf Thursday near Fort Hood, Texas, told CNN he witnessed the arrest of one of the two surviving suspects of the shooting at the Army installation. Shortly after the shooting, the officer said, military police told him to clear the course, and he saw other MPs surround the building that held the golf carts. The senior officer said he ducked into a nearby house for cover as 30 to 40 cars carrying MPs approached. He said he saw a soldier in battle dress uniform, his hands in the air. The MPs ordered him to lie on the ground and open his uniform, presumably to ensure he was not carrying explosives, the senior officer said. Presumably, they found no bomb. He said an MP told him that the authorities considered the man to be a suspect in the shootings after having overheard the man say he was with the shooter. The man was surrounded for 25 to 30 minutes until a convoy of vehicles arrived, led by a Ford Crown Victoria and carrying men in suits, and he was taken away. The senior officer said, sirening up to a suspect in 40 cars, wow, that's stealth for you. And who is the man? And where is he now? But they probably caught a few other suspects as well. I wonder if they're all Muslims. And speaking of that, how do we jibe Hassan's violent nature with Reuters' article, U.S. Army Gunman Acts Impossible? This was said by his grandfather. Okay, I'm not going to... And so it goes. The contradictions, the lies, the suspected truth of what this orchestrated event means and how it will bolster, supercharge resentment against Muslims once again and perpetuate our wars against their nations. And the folks who hold the puppet strings, will we be seeing them, hearing from them, or just listening to their news releases? Conflicting, accusatory, guilt in the highest from association. All I can say is, good night, America, and good luck. That was Jerry Mazza, writing in onlinejournal.com. The time, 12:33 in the p.m. The place, Nevada City, California. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show, Rabble Rousing. Well, I've got another rather lengthy article on the same subject of the Fort Hood shooting. I want to read you some excerpts. Hassan plus two other military men were originally all held as the shooters of the day on the day of the shooting. Later, the two were other two were released. But it begs the question, who shot the four SWAT police if Hassan was still sprawled on the transit hall floor with four bullets in him near dead? Beyond that, the Washington Post story gets even stranger. In the section subheaded, ending the shooting, Gray declined to specify who did what in the exchange of fire, saying those details must wait until the evidence is analyzed. Yet on Wednesday, we have a television interview with Oprah, no less, talking with Senior Sergeant Police Officer Mark Todd, who was described approaching Hassan's prone body, kicking his weapon and handcuffing him. Todd was one of two police persons that allegedly brought down Hassan. He also told Oprah, "We're trained to shoot until there's no longer a threat, and once he was lying down on his back, his weapon just fell out of his hand, and I'm like, okay, now's the time to rush him and secure him." If that isn't enough TV drama for you, here's more. Now, for some made-for-TV melodrama, is this real or staged? I read, you decide. The article continues. The other police person was Sergeant Kimberly Munley, who was wounded. As the Washington Post described her NBC TV Today show interference, Munley, sitting in a wheelchair with a blanket on her legs, said the knowledge that so many were killed was devastating. She added, "I wish that we would have gotten there faster to prevent any lives from being lost," with tears in her eyes, "because I know there's a lot of families out there suffering right now. I just wish the call would have come in quicker." Close quote. So do we all. Representative Peter Hoekstra of Michigan, top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, then stepped into Never Never Land, saying that sources beyond the intelligence community told him, quote, "Hassan had wired money to and communicated with people in Pakistan." He said he didn't know what the transfers were, but he did say, "It could simply be innocent money transfers, who knows, for earthquake relief," adding that he'd not been able to verify the allegation. But the sources were pretty good. Pretty good? Hassan's life hangs in the balance, as still another inference of alliances with Mideastern powers are being made, but not established. He goes on with a relevant sidebar. New York Times ran an article, key 9/11 suspect to be tried in New York. That would be the forlorn Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-named mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, who's been cooling his heels in Gitmo for several years, and who by now is probably ready to confess to planning Pearl Harbor and the sinking of the Maine. Four others accused of being in the plot will be prosecuted in New York City, a federal court as well. What follows from the Times is the real kicker. The decision about how to prosecute Mr. Mohammed and Mr. Nashiri have been particularly difficult because their defense lawyers are expected to argue that they were illegally tortured by the Central Intelligence Agency during their confinement, tainting any evidence gathered from their interrogations. The Bush administration later sent a so-called clean team to re-question the prisoners in preparation for military commission trials. A clean team? Did that include Procter & Gamble's original Mr. Clean? Pardon the levity, but it is induced by stretching belief like an old rubber band. It snaps. The Times' key paragraph states, "Documents have shown that the CIA used waterboarding, a controlled drowning technique, against Mr. Mohammed 183 times in March of 2003. Mr. Nashiri is one of two other detainees known to have been waterboarded before the Bush administration shut down the program, which high-level officials had approved after the Justice Department wrote legal memorandums, arguing that the president and commander-in-chief could authorize interrogators to bypass anti-torture laws. Arguing that the president could authorize interrogators to bypass anti-torture laws and do basically whatever he pleased and have U.S. citizens and the victims swallow it. That's all I will say about this, except that it's the kind of madness that Hassan, whether he's guilty, crazy, neither, or both, must be facing in the near future. if he's lucky enough to survive his hospital stay and not be visited by a contemporary Jack Ruby citizen gangster. Then he goes more scenarios, and he quotes a couple of readers that wrote to him. Let me see if there's anything. I think you've heard enough of this. Okay, there's one reader that's claiming. One interesting point came out. They haven't done any ballistics tests that we know of. And until the ballistics tests come out, we don't know if it was Hassan's weapons that killed those people, and we don't know whose weapons shot Hassan. This writer goes on to state, the real shooters were dressed in army fatigues. They pumped Hassan with 4 bullets and believed him to be totally dead. One of the real gunmen may have been shot and killed during their escape. The real gunmen who escaped were apprehended and then released back into the hands of the CIA. Okay. In summary, Hassan did not fire a single shot. He didn't even hold a gun. Whether or not this article pushes the envelope of believability, it is within the realm of possibility. We have come to understand the facts from previous false flag operations and assassination attempts. Here's another reader. Snap judgment. Hassan was the shooter. We haven't seen forensic evidence linking all the rounds fired to Hassan's gun and Hassan's gun to Hassan's hands. Any other rounds from other guns fired, either friendlies or suspects? No one's talking. Then we have the radical Islam cleric, Anwar al-Awlaki, who's pictured in classical al-Qaeda fiery cleric gear plus obligatory glasses and beard. He's linked by email addresses, by email and mosque to Major Hassan. Okay, you've heard enough of that. It does leave the media reporting on the Fort Hood shooting open to some very serious questions. All right. You want an example of shoddy reporting or incompetent journalism? Here it is. I know the incompetent reporter well for its eye. Some time back, I saw an interesting article in a magazine, and I ripped it out for use in a show sometime. I thought the pages mentioned the magazine's name and date, but I now see it does not. So I'm going to read you an article I can't source. Furthermore, it's too lengthy to read entirely, so I'm only going to read bits and pieces. How's that for shoddy reporting? However, I think the subject's interesting enough for you to get value from it, even with my half-assed treatment. The title and opening blurb might tell you all you need to know, but I'll read bits and pieces for you. The title is Real or Fake? Both Can Cure Depression. It's by Steve Silberman. And his opening blurb is, Sugar pills are getting more effective, and drug companies are desperate to know why. It's the placebo problem. Okay, I'm just going to read some highlighted sections. The fact that taking a FAO drug can powerfully improve some people's health, the so-called placebo effect, has long been considered an embarrassment to the serious practice of pharmacology. Despite the historic levels of industry investment in R&D, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved only 19 first-of-their-kind remedies in 2007, the fewest since 1983. Half of all the drugs that fail in later stage trials drop out of the pipeline due to the inability to beat sugar pills. In other words, they do tests with their new drugs and with sugar pills, and the sugar pills work just as effectively as the real drugs. The upshot's fewer new medicines available. Two comprehensive analyses of antidepressant trials have uncovered a dramatic increase in placebo response since the 80s. One estimated that the so-called effect size, a measure of statistical significance, in placebo groups has nearly doubled over that time. It's not that the old meds are getting weaker, drug developers say. It's as if the placebo effect is somehow getting stronger. Why are inert pills suddenly overwhelming promising new drugs and established medicines alike? The reasons are only just beginning to be understood. And if you read further into this article, you will discover they have no idea. A network of independent researchers is doggedly uncovering the inner workings. At the same time, drug makers are realizing they need to fully understand the mechanisms behind it so they can design trials that differentiate more clearly between the beneficial effects of their products and the body's innate ability to heal itself. By casting placebos as the villain, this one researcher ended up stigmatizing one of his most important discoveries. The fact that even dummy capsules can kickstart the body's recovery engine, and this became a problem for drug developers to overcome, rather than a phenomena that could guide doctors toward a better understanding of the healing process and how to drive it most effectively. If that isn't a comment against the whole medical establishment and the whole American system of doctoring for profit, I don't know what is. Rather than trying to discover what is the reasons why placebos are so effective and becoming more effective, they're just looking at it from a profit-making point of view. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Are you there?
You're there.
Good. Just a quick comment.
Yep.
This you're saying is a slap in the face to the pharmaceutical industry. It's just as much a slap in the face to the alternative medicine industry.
Please explain.
Well, alternative medicines, there are... You will have to admit there are some charlatans in that industry.
Absolutely.
They take advantage.
Sure.
Oh,
I got your point. Sure.
Yeah.
Any medicine or any purported medicine may be beneficial and it may not be beneficial. What they're not factoring into is the placebo effect might work in either case.
I absolutely agree. And mm-hmm. I think the placebo effect, I think, should be investigated scientifically.
Sure. And... this article kind of gets around that. The problem with investigating it scientifically is who's going to pay for that investigation.
Good point, Jamba.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Okay, and thank you for raising your point.
Not a problem.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, have we covered this sufficiently? Yeah, the point that it brings out is that there's a higher brain function involved. And the body's ability to heal itself is what seems to be triggered by the placebo effect. And they have done some experiments where they had three groups. One group was simply given a medication. Another group was given a placebo. But there was no counseling support with the giving of that placebo. And then the last group was given the placebo, but they were also given lots of encouraging counseling to go along with it. Well, needless to say, it was the third group, the last group that did the best. So it seems like giving a patient anything and then inculcating the idea in them that this is going to help them, that seems to be very beneficial to their cure. Or to improving their condition. Okay, I think we've got enough on that one. Treasury system versus Federal Reserve system. This is by Arthur J. Ramos. And it's just an address, so it's not a... I don't know what website it came off. This essay was written some time ago, so some of the figures are inaccurate, but the principles apply. Zero income tax. How would you like to receive a letter from the Internal Revenue Service stating that your tax due from last year's income is zero, and that your future income will not be taxed by the federal government. Many people believe that taxes are a necessary evil. It's their patriotic duty to pay taxes. The idea that the federal government needs revenue from taxes to keep it operating is totally false. State and local governments do need revenue to pay for their expenses. However, the federal government falls into a different category. To show how federal taxes can be eliminated, it's first necessary to discuss the role of money in our economy. To be able to transfer goods and services from the producers to the purchaser requires money. There must be an adequate amount of money either instantly available or can be easily borrowed that will allow for an easy flow of trading. Because our economy is continuously growing, there is a continuous need to add money to the nation's money supply. If there's not enough money available, much of the goods and services will not be produced or sold. The economy will contract. If the shortage of money continues for a long time, there would be a severe downturn in the economy, resulting in increases in bankruptcies, company downsizing, and job layoffs, which economists call a recession. Simply, because of national growth and anticipated growth, we need brand new money coming into the economy. The best way to increase the money supply is have the government, specifically the Treasury, to create money and issue currency and or checks to people, organizations, and companies who are doing business with the government, such as suppliers, contractors, and employees. The government will be paying its obligations through Treasury money. The people and companies receiving this money would deposit it into local banks, where the money will become part of our money supply, thus increasing the money in circulation. There would be no need for the government to borrow money. The Treasury money is created into existence without Treasury bonds, without taxes, and without interest charges. This money is not added to the national debt. Eventually, through this system, the present national debt could be reduced to zero. So let's compare that with a Treasury system. This type of money system, where Congress controls our money, can be called a Treasury system. Congress sets the monetary policy, and the Treasury would be responsible for creating and extinguishing our money. Our Constitution provides Congress the legal right to do this. I'm going to have to skip through this. We're running low on time. Privately owned banks and companies would not be allowed to create money. Notice that the Federal Reserve System is, which does create the money, is a privately owned bank. Back to the article. The Federal Reserve banks would become part of the Treasury. Privately owned banks and companies would not be allowed to create money. Loans made by the banks would be based on actual dollars the banks have on their books. Banks would be allowed to charge a small amount of interest on loan money. Fractional reserve banking and federal bank reserves are out. All checks would clear through the Treasury. Our country has never operated on a Treasury system model. Okay, well, should I go on with this? Oh, well, I guess the tag to the article is Congressman Dennis Kucinich will be introducing legislation to accomplish the above based on the American Monetary System Act, as proposed by Stephen Zarlinga. So we do have some people in Congress that are actually trying to change the system and serving the people. Dennis Kucinich is one, Ron Paul is another, and the interesting thing is these guys are at absolute opposite ends of the political spectrum. One of them being extremely liberal and progressive, the other being extremely conservative. And here they have the same idea and the same perspective on the true economic problems of our country and our system. So I'm not going to belabor you by going further. Here's a fun one. Do I have time to get through it? I think so. How are some middle-class families coping with the recession? Growing pot. This is by Susan Kuchinkas, MillerMcCune.com. Sarah's whole street reeks of pot. This is not hyperbole. When you turn the corner into this lane of 1970s tract houses, you smell the tang, the sour, earthy, green odor that wafts up from lush marijuana plants steaming in the sun. Sarah estimates that 7 of the 10 households on her semi-rural street, a couple of miles from white bread suburban Rohnert Park, California, are growing weed. She ran into one neighbor at the hardware store in the new section devoted to cultivation, with a special dirt, fertilizer, and outsized plastic pots that growers use. Her next-door neighbors, two brothers, trade plant-sitting with her and let their pit bulls loose at night to patrol both yards. The woman across the street has a small crop in their vegetable garden, and the new couple on the block, noticing the smell, mentioned they'd like to get in on it. In fact, she says she doesn't know anyone in Sonoma County who isn't growing pot. This person doesn't fit the image of a drug dealer. She's 58, colors her hair strawberry blonde, and wears souvenir t-shirts, jeans, and Crocs. Her ranch-style three-bedroom home is filled with furniture from Costco and cat-themed knickknacks. She seems as mainstream as they come, and she's typical of the new breed of marijuana producer in Northern California. As the economy tanked, layoffs rose, retirement savings shriveled, and home equity credit lines fizzled, Sarah and thousands of middle-class folks like her began raising extra cash by following local ordinances that allowed the limited growing of cannabis sativa for personal medicinal use, while hoping that President Barack Obama will keep federal law enforcers occupied with other things. The economics of pot growing is nice. The amount of space included needed to grow a tomato plant will support a cannabis plant that, with a bit of THC and luck, will produce from 1/4 pound to as much as 2 pounds of marijuana. When wholesale to a dispensary, each pound will bring around $2,000. Sarah's printing business has been going downhill since 2005. Now it's totally gone, she says. She's planned to sell her parents' home, invest the money, and retire, but the house didn't sell. So 2 years ago, she fenced off a plot in her backyard and put in marijuana. She harvested about 3 pounds, cleared $4,000. Last fall, she spent $10,000 to build a 12-square-foot shed in her backyard, fitted with lights, fans, and an exhaust system. She just harvested her first indoor crop, 4 pounds, that she sold for $12,000. I have money in my pocket again for the first time since 2000, she says. The term of choice is medical marijuana, or sometimes just medicine. California has a patchwork of local ordinances designed to enable the production of medical marijuana, and a cottage industry that enables almost anyone to qualify. Local governments are doing more than looking away. Some are looking to pot to save their financial butts. As California state legislatures slashed funding for education and social services and siphoned an additional $2 billion from local government treasuries, voters in Oakland found a way to put some back. In July this year, the city of 400,000 voted for a 1.8% extra sales tax on medicinal marijuana. The measure could raise nearly $300,000 next year alone. Okay, we're out of time.
Yep.
Let's close with this one. This is from the Humor Times. Do we have great leaders in America? Yes, we do. Only they're often not whom we expect. Here's my nominee for Leader of the Week. Will Phillips, a 10-year-old from Arkansas, won't stand for the flag or recite the Pledge of Allegiance at school. Why? In his own words, I really don't feel there's currently liberty and justice for all. The Arkansas Times reports that this all started over a conversation Will had with his parents. They have gay friends, and have increasingly been disappointed by the way gay and lesbian Americans have to fight for their rights. During a car ride, the family began discussing the Pledge of Allegiance. Not a typical family discussion topic, but then again, Will Phillips is anything but a typical 10-year-old. When Will identified a problem in standing for the pledge that says, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It seems Will had a problem reciting this daily when he knew that lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender people are discriminated against on a daily basis, both locally and as a result of federal law. Will asked his parents if it was legal for him to refuse to stand and say the Pledge of Allegiance at his school. It is. So Will decided to take matters into his own hands. On Monday, October 5th, when Will went to class, he refused to stand for the pledge like the rest of his classmates. He had a substitute teacher that week, and at first she let this slide. As the week went on, she became angry, though. By Thursday of the week, she was putting more and more pressure on Will to comply. She brought up Will's mother in the conversation, saying that she would want him to stand and participate in the Pledge of Allegiance. This didn't sit well, as Will himself relates. She got a lot more angry and raised her voice and brought up my mom and my grandma up. I was fuming and was too furious to really pay attention to what she was saying. After a few minutes, I said, "With all due respect, ma'am, you can go jump off a bridge." Will was sent to the principal's office. His mother, Laura Phillips, was called. Her first question was why it was that her child, a boy who loves learning and skipped from the third to the fifth grade, was telling a teacher to jump off a bridge. The principal eventually told Will's mother that Will wouldn't stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, and after repeated attempts made by the teacher to have Will comply with her wishes, the incident had occurred. Eventually, the principal conceded that Will was not required to say the pledge by either law or school policy. On that basis, Laura Phillip asked when she could expect an apology from the substitute teacher. None has been forthcoming. On October 20th, Will gave a speech about the incident, which his parents have generously put on YouTube. End of the article. Okay, we got a leader. Now who's going to follow?